Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Kathy Kelly, board president of the group World Beyond War, who talks about the ongoing slaughter of Palestinian civilians in Gaza and what an international network of peace organizations is asking of the United Nations to stop the killing. Rachel Carroll Rivas of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who examines the increasing threat posed by violent right-wing hate groups and white supremacist armed militias after Donald Trump takes office in January. And Michael Richardson of Third Act Upstate New York, who discusses the three-day December climate protest at the state capitol in Albany to pressure Governor Kathy Hochul to sign the Make Polluters Pay bill. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
United States war planners at the National Defense Strategy Commission, a bipartisan group tasked with reviewing America's national defense strategies, are calling in its most recent report for the U.S. to develop a plan to engage in three possible future theaters of war in Ukraine, the Middle East, and the Indo-Pacific. The commission's strategists assert that confronting the combined military power of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea is a major challenge that will require the U.S. to significantly expand its military and massively increase defense spending. But in his second term, President-elect Donald Trump's response to this strategy will be unpredictable, contradictory, and at times dangerously irrational, as witnessed in his first 4 years in the White House. Trump simultaneously has vowed to make the world's most powerful country more isolationist, less aggressive toward Russia, more hostile toward China and America's own allies, and more hawkish on defense spending, as he declares global challenges like the climate crisis to be a hoax. With the incoming Trump administration promising the largest mass deportation of immigrants in U.S. history, corporations and private equity firms invested in detention facilities and their suppliers are lining up for a huge payday. Stock prices of the private prison corporations, Geo Group and CoreCivic, soared after Trump's election. The links between private equity and the private prison and detention complex is mostly below the radar. But a new report by the watchdog group, the Private Equity Shareholder Project, connects the dots. Senior researcher Azani Creeks told The Intercept that declaring a national emergency in connection with Trump's mass deportation plan will open up all these avenues for some dubious companies to rush in without proper vetting. Companies with the most political connections and money will win government contracts. Among the top private equity health providers is WellPath, that operates in 12 detention facilities. The company currently faces over 1,000 lawsuits, including 70 alleging wrongful deaths. Another company, TKC Holdings, served immigrants in a facility in Laredo, Texas, where detainees complained of inedible food and undrinkable, foul-smelling water. Many private equity firms that provide services to detention centers also provide surveillance systems used to track immigrants and hold contracts to deport them. A week before Christmas, Amazon delivery drivers and Starbucks baristas went on strike in several U.S. cities, exerting pressure on the two companies to recognize them as unionized employees or to meet demands to negotiate an initial labor contract. At the same time, Whole Foods workers in Philadelphia are looking to make a breakthrough in voting to form the first union at the upscale food market. As reported by In These Times, Amazon, which owns Whole Foods, is virulently anti-union and employs an aggressive program to suppress pro-union activity. Since Amazon bought the company in 2017, Whole Foods has undergone a long list of changes, many workers say, for the worse. In addition to safety concerns, chronic understaffing, and unrealistic and exhausting productivity metrics, low wages and insufficient benefits are among the other issues motivating the Whole Foods union drive. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As 2024 comes to a close, the carnage inflicted by Israel on Palestinians living in Gaza is difficult to comprehend. Over the past 14 months of the war, that began after the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages, Israel's airstrikes and ground assault has now killed 45,000 Palestinians, up to 70% of them women and children. 10,000 more of the dead are believed to be buried under tons of rubble, according to Gaza's health ministry. Haunting assessments from the United Nations and international aid agencies conclude that nearly 70% of Gaza's housing, schools, and basic infrastructure have been destroyed by Israeli bombing or demolition, with only 36% of primary health centers still functioning. Due to Israel's blockade of humanitarian food deliveries and medical aid, both starvation and disease are now widespread among Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinian residents. Despite the International Court of Justice investigation into charges that Israel is engaged in genocide in Gaza and arrest warrants issued by the International Criminal Court for Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu, Defense Minister Gallant, and a Hamas commander for war crimes, the slaughter in Gaza continues. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, a lifelong nonviolence activist and board president of the group World Beyond War. Here she talks about the catastrophic situation in Gaza and what an international network of peace organizations, Global Solidarity for Peace in Palestine, is asking of the United Nations to stop the killing in Gaza.
Well, Scott, perhaps one of the most telling realities is that children are saying, majority numbers, we don't want to live any longer. They don't expect to live, and they've said we don't want to because it's such a desperate, dismal situation in which they find themselves. Scott, I had a chance to be on phone calls in October with Palestinians living in Gaza and in the West Bank. And I remember one man saying, the final solution is being enacted against us now. And I also then remembered being a teenager and thinking, how could anyone in Germany or Europe or the United States, for that matter, have learned of the German plan for a final solution to eradicate European Jewry and not have wanted to take steps to prevent that? But here we are now looking at what Palestinians are telling us is a final solution. And what we're seeing is increased indifference nurtured by mainstream media on the part of elites and capitals all around the world, instead of seeing a concerted, determined resolve to say we must have an immediate, permanent ceasefire. So I think the United Nations is where we must turn, but it's been quite difficult for member states of the United Nations to go up against the most powerful groups within the Security Council to say this must stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kathy, in your recent article titled When Will the UN General Assembly Suspend Israel, you discuss a letter from the international coalition called Global Solidarity for Peace in Palestine. What are the signers of this letter requesting from the United Nations and the General Assembly with regards to Israel's violation of international law and human rights?
Well, the General Assembly will be headed by the Ambassador of Algeria to the United Nations, Mr. Benjama, in January. And he could call for hearings and bring in expert witnesses from Amnesty International, from Human Rights Watch, from Doctors Without Borders, and make the case for suspending Israel because Israel has itself flouted international law. I mean, it's so telling that on his way out, the outgoing Israeli ambassador to the United Nations went to the podium to give his final talk, and with him he was carrying a portable paper shredder, and he shredded the United Nations charter in front of, you know, a kind of an appalled audience. And when you look at the Negev Desert and the Shimon Peres Nuclear Research Center, and underneath those desert sands are possibly 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons, and Israel never acknowledges that it possesses that nuclear weaponry. Then you have the ways in which Israel has, because of its illegal occupation, flouted international law, particularly after the International Court of Justice ruled that the entire occupation is illegal. So member states have an obligation, not just an opportunity, an obligation, to stop all trade with Israeli settlements, to stop any shipment of weapons to Israel, to definitely call on a shunning of the country of Israel from the General Assembly. And I think that this could be done, but the United States would very likely retaliate in a very strong way against any country that would try to take these kinds of steps, and so people are afraid. But we are seeing some differences. I mean, for instance, Ireland has spoken out very vociferously against Israel's actions that have violated international law in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And so Israel closed its embassy in Dublin. And the Irish president and prime minister and others have said, well, you know, if you want to know what we think is reprehensible, it's the killing of children. It's the constant attacks against UN sanctuaries, against UN workers in the region, against UNRWA. So I think we are beginning to see more of a readiness on the part of member states of the United Nations General Assembly to say the whole edifice of international law is going to be so horribly undermined. We're seeing the de-evolution, the devolution of international law, and we can't afford this. We're living in a time when ecological collapse threatens the entire planet. We more than ever need edifices of international law.
That was Kathy Kelly, a lifelong nonviolence activist and board president of the group World Beyond War. Find a link to her recent article titled, When Will the UN General Assembly Suspend Israel? And related news and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During his 2024 presidential election campaign, Donald Trump regularly stoked hate and fear, targeting immigrants, communities of color, and trans youth. As he prepares to be sworn into office in January, Trump has reiterated that he'll follow through on his campaign pledge to pardon some or all of his 1,500 MAGA supporters charged with crimes related to the violent January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection that resulted in the deaths of five people and injuries to 174 police officers. There's growing concern that many of the right-wing hate groups, Christian nationalists, and white supremacist armed militias that support Donald Trump will be emboldened by his return to the White House that could result in a dangerous increase in political violence targeting Trump's perceived enemies. In June, the Southern Poverty Law Center published a report titled The Year in Hate and Extremism 2023, which documents the activities of more than 1,400 hate and anti-government extremist organizations, the highest number of active white nationalist groups ever recorded by the organization. These record numbers coincide with a rise in direct actions targeting minority communities, including blacks, Jews, LGBTQ+ people, as well as libraries, schools, and hospitals. Your reporter spoke with Rachel Carol Rivas, interim director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, who talks about the heightened level of concern regarding the threat posed by racist hate groups after Donald Trump takes office in January.
I mean, many people at the state level have had to deal with kind of these repressive, regressive, authoritarian states for a while. So I think we have some lessons to learn from folks in the Deep South, in some of our states, that they've had to deal with some of these things at the state level. It is different when it's the federal level. You can't move states. You can't change locations. It's different when you have the kind of the level of influence, power, money, institution that a president would have. And I think it is really concerning that there are a number of people that are being put in positions who have been directly associated, involved with the hard right in the U.S. hate groups. When we look at something like Project 2025, many of the things that we were kind of talked about it during the election cycle were around the policies that were in that document outlined by in a coalition effort by the Heritage Foundation. The policies are appalling. But the second piece of that effort was an effort to have a ready-made list of people that could be put into positions of power during the nominations, the appointment process. And we see that playing out. And the associations are not good with groups. And there are many folks there who are being put forward who absolutely are happy to enact really regressive policies and have long histories of buddying up to hate groups. So I think there's absolutely a concern. I think the places that we might find a little hope is that people are pretty resistant to, as a whole, to when it sort of becomes a reality in their space. We've seen that resistance at the state level in the South. We've seen that during the last administration. So I'm hopeful that people will say no. I think that there is a real risk, though.
Rachel, I did want to ask you about this. With Trump's control of all three branches of government come January 20th, including the Department of Justice and the FBI, is it likely that investigations into armed right-wing militia or other white supremacist terrorist groups would be diminished or ended? Mm-hmm. We've seen Republicans in the past try to expunge any investigation or public reports about the threat these white supremacist groups pose to the country. If that were to come to pass, what would be the result of little or no federal monitoring or prosecution of these groups?
Yeah. I'm absolutely concerned about that because we have seen a number of Department of Justice arrests of neo-Nazi terrorist groups that were planning to attack our infrastructure, including our electric infrastructure, our transportation infrastructure. We've seen a number of kind of budding local militias that were kind of nipped in the bud by the DOJ these last few years. And we know that it's one of the only things that has really slowed down, particularly the more violent direct action kind of militia and white supremacist groups in this U.S. has been actually an attention by our federal law enforcement. That was true after Oklahoma City, and that's true this time. We see an impact on that. I think that that there is unfortunate likelihood that that will wane and will refocus as it has before, irresponsibly and incorrectly, on Black and Brown communities and activist groups. I think the other real concerning thing for me is that we've had an ATF that's really leaned into making sure to crack down on the weapons issues in our country, in which many of these groups are involved in, particularly the militia movement, and everything from ghost guns to illegal sales. If that are eyes off, we have a massive problem, especially in a country where we already have, quite frankly, a mass armed society where, you know, militias used to be the folks with all the guns. And now it's like we've got, you know, anyone can really be a part of militia because the guns are everywhere. So I think if ATF is taking their eyes off, that's also particularly concerning in this moment.
That was Rachel Carol Rivas, interim director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Learn more about the group's work, as well as news and information, about the rising threat posed by violent right-wing hate groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From December 10th through 12th, dozens of elder and youth activists gathered for a protest in the War Room outside New York Governor Kathy Hochul's office at the Capitol in Albany. They were there to pressure her to sign the Climate Change Superfund Act, known widely as the Make Polluters Pay Bill. During the three-day protest, 19 climate activists were arrested for engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience. The legislation would require the largest fossil fuel companies to pay $3 billion a year for 25 years in compensation for the pollution they've emitted over the previous two decades. The money raised would help pay to repair damage from past climate-fueled storms and harden the state's infrastructure to prepare for future storm destruction. If signed into law, the bill would also provide funding to address public health issues, such as asthma, which is exacerbated by fossil fuels' toxic emissions. The mid-December protest at the Capitol included a sit-in, teach-in, sing-in, and die-in, as well as a rousing rally, where participants chanted, "Make polluters pay." Michael Richardson, an activist with the elder focus group Third Act, initiated the action with his friend Sheldon Pollock and the youth climate group Fridays for Future NYC. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, a participant in the action, spoke with Richardson, who explains what the bill would do and why he believes this protest action was necessary.
The past few years, a coalition has been writing a very long sentence of why this needs to be done. And what Sheldon and I saw is that we really needed something at the end that was more than another phone relay or another one-hour rally on the million-dollar staircase, that we really needed to have an exclamation point on the back of that long sentence. And we thought that we would mobilize an interfaith, intergenerational, intercultural, sit-in, teach-in, sing-in, borrowing on strategies to go way back to the Vietnam sit-ins of the 1970s, 1960s, that really started at the University of Michigan. And as you can see from today, we had roughly 200 people, intergenerational, intercultural, interfaith, show up. And, well, we've been here since 10 o'clock this morning. Most of us are going to stay until the building closes this evening, at which time we think that we'll be asked to leave, and some of us won't. So 2.5 day sit-in, teach-in, sing-in, who knows, civil disobedience. But one thing I want to be clear about here, the Climate Change Superfund does not do anything about greenhouse gases. This is going to the oil companies and saying, you guys caused all this pollution that caused the storms that's causing us to have all this damage and poor health. And we, the taxpayers, are being stuck with it. This is about playing fair. We could really call this the Municipal Taxpayer Relief Act. We do have other legislation, and this is why this is so important, because this other legislation, Cap Trade and Invest, and other bills that are coming forward, bills to regulate these peaker plants that fire up every time, dirty oil, dirty gas. Those are things where we're going after the greenhouse gases today and tomorrow. And that's where it affects our neighboring states. But even the Superfund Act, which is about past emissions, paying for the damage those past emissions cause, has a nationwide impact because Vermont has passed the bill, right? New York is next. This bill is on the desk in Massachusetts, in Maryland, in California. So it is essential that New York do this to show the other states that it can be done.
So I understand that there was a scientific reckoning of which companies owed which amounts. Is that right?
Yes, there's a formula that has been largely agreed to where we know how much oil they produced in barrels, and we know how much gas they put through their pipeline in cubic feet, and we also know how many tons of coal that they produced. So We could, there's records are there, and so you use a formula that if you burn those materials at a certain efficiency, that you create a certain amount of carbon dioxide and methane and the like. So the metrics are there. But of course, the larger producers, Saudi Aramco, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Total, BP, those are going to be paying more than some other companies that will be paying less. So there's roughly 30 companies that are in the mix. The math works out that Saudi Aramco is such a heavy, heavy producer that they end up paying the bulk of the largest amount. And number two, number three, number four are right up there. So if you add their percentages, it gets to be about 60% of the fund will be coming from those four or five top companies.
From your perspective, how has it been, you know, organizing mostly elders, like mostly through Third Act and, you know, organizing with the teenagers?
I get the sense from Summer of Heat when an intergenerational, intercultural group came together for holding Citigroup accountable for their financing of fossil fuel projects, that there is a strong desire for us to come together in unity on these campaigns, to get out of our silos and out of our unique groups and lead out. But Third Act, of course, has as its foundation that this is to be youth-led. And us as seniors, where we vote at a high level and we have a lot of assets that are invested in the markets, that we should be backing the youth up. And so our real mission is not to lead the youth, but to back up the youth. So this is an example of that coming together. But I tell you, what's important here is not just the bill. That's our focus. It's the movement. We have a long slog ahead of us. This is only the beginning.
That was Michael Richardson, an activist with the group Third Act Upstate New York. Learn more about New York State's Make Polluters Pay legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky and Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.